The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Eric Spofford's story is one that's becoming more and more familiar with Granite Staters.
As an IV heroin addict, when I was 15 years old, starting at that point in time, up until almost the time I got sober, I never thought I was going to have a long life. I thought I was going to die. I thought I was going to go to prison for an incredibly long time, which, by all means, I should have.
The difference? Eric is alive to tell it. Last year, more than 400 people died in New Hampshire from opioid-related overdoses. Eric's story is among those featured in a new documentary on how the national epidemic has disrupted lives in the picturesque town of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The heroin effect goes beyond the stories of tragedy to challenge traditional narratives on the nature, perception, and treatment of addiction. It premieres tonight at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. And joining us to talk about the film are director Michael Venn, producer Carlina Lyons, and Sandy Coyle. She's a recovery advocate who's in the heroin effect. Michael, Carlina, Sandy, hello.
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 Thank you so much for coming in. I mean, we've certainly heard and seen many of these kind of stories, right? And heard politicians and officials talk about the lives and communities affected by this epidemic. Michael, I'm curious, what made you want to make a film about it?
The short version of that story is I live in Portsmouth. I was walking home one day after getting a cup of coffee with my son. And, every headline at the coffee shop was a heroin overdose, heroin epidemic, national issue. And it was, the Portsmouth Herald, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. I finished the walk home and ran into a friend of mine. I had said, "Hey, man, I haven't seen you in a long time. How are things?" And he goes, "Oh, things are all right." And he had been in a car accident. And he goes, "Yeah, do you know the whole story?" And I said, "No." He said, "Yeah, I'm a heroin addict. I nodded out on 101. I totaled my truck. I'm lucky to be alive. And I've been in recovery for like 11 months. And I looked at him and my jaw hit the floor, because this is a kid who is, good looking, well educated, comes from a good family, has a master's degree. And he's the kid who you want your child to grow up to be like. He's the kid you want your daughter to date. He didn't fit the stereotype of a heroin addict. So we talked a little bit longer, and I walked home and wrote a couple pages, which became the outline for this film.
Carlina, I know you've been active in the film community for a long time. It was also a personal connection for you. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Well, Michael and I have known each other for probably 10 years and worked together a lot at this point. So when he came up with the idea for the film, he also knew that I had lost a sister to heroin. And so he came to me and asked if I wanted to be involved in this. And absolutely, because this is what I can do with my toolkit. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a filmmaker, and I can bring that toolkit to this crisis.
How long ago did you lose your sister?
She died in 2005.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, thank you.
Well, but what a thing you're bringing to the community. Sandy, you are one of the people who is in the film. We see you quite a bit. Here's a clip of you talking in the film about your experience.
So I actually got a job at a child care center, and it was a really short-term job, but there were two times within that job that during nap time, kids would all be laying there, and I would go in the bathroom and I would snort a line, and it was supposed to be cleaning the room while the kids were sleeping, and I would basically just be doped up sitting against the wall. I quickly started to realize that there was something wrong.
Sandy Coyle there in a clip from The Heroin Effect. She's with us now. And Sandy, you look, very together, very professional. And we see you in this film, and we also see shots of this town, this lovely little town. And there's a kind of disconnect between maybe our traditional thinking of what an addict looks like, where they grow up, what kind of dingy apartment they're in, rather than this expensive little chic town with a bunch of restaurants. What is that disconnect about?
I guess I wonder if we would ever ask, what does
what does a cancer patient look like? What does someone with diabetes look like? We don't ask those questions of any other health issue. So, you know, hearing that clip is hard for me, because what I've really focused on for the last 12 plus years, and my purpose in being a part of this film was really to bring the face of recovery. And what I've come to learn is that I hid in my addiction almost as much as I was hiding in my recovery. I was just as ashamed about being a person in recovery as I was being a person who was struggling with the addiction. And when I learned that there were people sharing their face and their voice as a message of hope, as people who had overcome addiction, that's where I realized my fit was. And it doesn't have a look. It happens. And recovery happens too. And that's what I wanted to convey, is that anybody that may be struggling with addiction had those doorways to find hope and had the connections to people that had walked through it and were available to help them.
So you must have gone through quite a process to make yourself this public.
It was a huge process, and I didn't even realize the process that it was going to be. And I guess that's the beauty of life, is that this is all a story. This is all a journey. We're all living our own stories. We're all living our own journeys. And what happens out of people being willing to share their stories is hopeful, is vulnerability, is connectedness. And for folks that are affected by substance use disorders, it really goes a long way to know that you're not alone. And there's a lot of different ways that you can go about getting help.
I'm thinking that for you, Michael and Carlina, that must have been a conscious decision. I mean, we've seen a lot of these terribly sad stories about people who've lost a son or a daughter or a spouse or a girlfriend or a friend. And here we see Sandy, we see Eric, we see Dean, others living in recovery with all the challenges of recovery. But what was behind that decision?
So very early on, like when I came up with the idea to do the film, my whole goal was to do something different. You know, you think heroin, you think, okay, needles, spoons. Your traditional version of that story is find somebody who's an addict and follow them around and see what happens. And it generally is a very sad story. And it doesn't tell what I kind of realized is a really good truth. And it's another side of a story that we never hear anymore. And so I wanted to tell that. And I think the big part of it was, like, because it's a new version of a story. I mean, I met Sandy and I was blown away by her story. When I met Eric, who we opened with, you know, his story is amazing, and Dean, and there's tons of stories like that, but that story isn't perpetuated in the media. So I wanted to do something different. And setting that goal right off the bat of no spoons, no needles, nobody shooting up, but telling an honest story and getting all perspectives. I mean, there's people in recovery, there's people that are struggling, you know, in this film. So, you know, I wanted to really kind of share those realities.
Absolutely. And I think that is important. And in addition to that, we also do have people at different stages in their recovery in the film, because even though we want to highlight the success stories to show people that there is hope, we also need to acknowledge that not everyone has a successful story, unfortunately.
Well, let's hear actually from one of those. This is a man in active addiction. His name is Daniel Cousins, and he makes videos of himself and post them. Sometimes, you know, these flashes of optimism, like, I'm going to kick this, and then sometimes nodding off. Here's Daniel Cousins.
All the time, my brain is like this freaking, like, conference room of people yelling at each other, all different things, and it's changing constantly. And then you just know that there's something, and it's just going to silence it, and you can just be yourself and smile. And I mean, like, why wouldn't you want that? But of course, I don't want to be, you know, a drug addict.
That's a clip from the film The Heroin Effect. It's a documentary on how the opioid epidemic is hitting Portsmouth. Director Michael Venn and producer Carlina Lyons are with us, as is Sandy Coyle. She's now a recovery advocate who's in the film. The film is premiering tonight at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. So what did Daniel's story bring to this?
Daniel's story we were really lucky with, because it's really intimate. You know, he kept a video diary on his phone. It breaks the fourth wall. It's very intimate. It is his therapist, his best friend. You know, you see him when he's high. You see him when he's not. And you get an inner dialogue that is very truthful.
Well, we hear from policymakers, law enforcement, press conferences, when recovery centers are open, marches, you know, people in recovery pushing up against ideas about addiction. I think we are, as a society, moving on a little bit from this idea of addiction as a moral failing or, you know, failure of personality. But there's a very interesting conversation in the film with Johan Hari. Does somebody want to set this up for us? First, he explains this old experiment with the rats in the cage.
Yeah, that was the Partnership for the Drug-Free America advertisement, which was, you know, very Hollywood done in dramatic music. But it was, you know, you take a rat, you put it in a cage, you give it two bottles of water. One has heroin, one has, you know, it's just water. And the lonely rat drinks the heroin-laced water and dies.
So this was the first experiment done on this. Now there's an updated version by a researcher named Bruce Alexander. And this is Johan Hari from the film The Heroin Effect.
So he built a cage that he called Rat Park, which is basically heaven for rats. Anything a rat can want in life, it's got in Rat Park. It's got loads of friends, it can have loads of sex, it's got loads of cheese, it's got loads of coloured balls, it's got loads of tunnels. And they've got both the water bottles, the normal water and the drug water. But this is the fascinating thing. They all try both the water bottles because they don't know what's in them. In Rat Park, they don't like the drug water. They almost never use it. None of them ever use it compulsively. None of them ever overdose. The opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection.
The opposite of addiction is connection. We know, right? It's nourishing, it's life-sustaining from a lot of research. But it's not an easy thing to engineer or to legislate. The implication is that we all have a role in this. What are you thinking our role is?
A lot of people still look at the problem who have not been personally affected, and they think it does not affect them. Or they look at it in a way where it's a choice. And to me, regardless of, and this is a little cold, but regardless of how you feel about how people come to addiction, the truth is it is affecting you. Loss of income for the community, loss of tax dollars, loss of contribution to the community, resources of the medical community and the police communities. There are all these resources that are going towards people, and all these resources are growing, you know, throwing these law enforcement at them, and they're not working. And it's coming out of a taxpayer's pocket, to be honest, and cold. So even if you don't care about this problem with your heart, which you should, because you're, you know, we're all people and we're all faulted, you should care about this problem with your wallet.
Anybody else want to pick up on that? The sort of idea of, you know, who is the audience for this? And what are you saying to the community at large?
I think part of my message and reason for standing up was I've been a professional. I've gone back and got my master's degree. I'm a daughter. I'm a single mother. I show up on the sidelines for the soccer games, and I sit at conference tables and do strategic planning. What was really kind of groundbreaking for me is to be able to publicly identify as a person in recovery and challenge that question of what does addiction look like and what do we know about recovery? You know, when Mike talks about seeing all the headlines with fatalities and the havoc it was having in our communities, I realized that I am part of a community of people that talk about how their lives are second to none and how they're able to show up at the soccer games and show up at work because of what recovery has given them, because of what they were able to overcome. You know, as far as what the community could do about it, I saw a real failing in a lot of different parts of our state and legislature, our country, in stepping up and addressing this the right way. Policy may be one piece of it, funding may be one piece of it, but how we treat people. Looking at the incarceration rates, we have been trying to arrest our way out of it. And I had seen, you know, gotten a glimpse of other communities that were stepping forward to say, we can create a doorway for people to access different pathways to recovery. We can be a part of breaking the stigma so that people aren't treated as moral failings, but people that are struggling with a health issue and deserve adequate care. So we were also able to create a groundswell in Portsmouth specifically to open a recovery center that's there now and welcomes people through the doors at Safe Harbor Recovery Center.
There's a question that's asked early in the film about why New Hampshire in particular?
I think it's an issue that's everywhere. I mean, I think that, you know, the setting of this film happens to be in New Hampshire. It happens to be a, you know, a seacoast New England town. But, it's everywhere. You know, as I researched and kind of reached out to a lot of people and Johan and stuff like that, I mean, we're seeing the numbers that we're seeing because of fentanyl. We're seeing it because, you know, the reason why people are talking about it and politicians are talking about it during the election cycle is, you know, the overdoses, you know, and the deaths. If we didn't have those death tolls, I don't know if we'd be talking about it. And it's good that we're talking about it now.
Michael Venn, he is the director of the film The Heroin Effect. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Carlina Lyons, producer. Thank you, Carlina. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Sandy Coyle, she is New England Regional Director for Phoenix Multisport. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
She's also in the film The Heroin Effect. You can find out more about tonight's premiere at the Music Hall in Portsmouth and see a clip of the film at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. I'm pretty sure you cannot get through 24 hours of New England classic rock without hearing this. But here's a twist. That is not Jimmy Page, Robert Plant, and all playing Kashmir, but Led Zeppelin, the all-female Led Zeppelin tribute band. They're going to be playing at the Flying Monkey in Plymouth this Friday. Steph Payne is the lead guitarist and founder of Led Zeppelin. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Just remind me, what was the name of that song again?
I guess you've played that song a few times, though, haven't you, Steph?
A few times, backwards and forwards, upside down. Yes, indeed. Listen, Kashmir is, I think, next to Stairway, I suppose, is just one of those epic things that when you burst into it, people, you know, they just fade into joyous revelry, you know. Everyone loves it. It's got this a mystical thing.
Well, and that's what you're doing, right? You are bringing people, transporting them somehow to a Led Zeppelin show in your own way. You've been doing this since 2004. You're the founder. How did this all start?
It was either the greatest idea I ever had or the worst idea I ever had. No, it was sort of this, who knows, divine intervention. I think Jimmy came to me in a dream and planted the idea in my mind or something. Honestly, it was as simple as me being between gigs. I'd been on the road with Ronnie Spector for a couple of years and enjoyed doing that. And I just had a hankering for playing something heavy. And I was completely in love with Led Zeppelin. You know, I had sort of rediscovered it as you know, many people have, which is the thing about Led Zeppelin that's so amazing. I'm not sure there's any band that has withstood the test of time quite like Led Zeppelin. I mean, the Beatles were not an issue that they would, but, you know, I think Led Zeppelin is just, it almost sounds better, I think, in a way now, more recently. And I just had this idea, you know, to indulge myself and go get a couple of girls together and play the music. It was really this innocent, well, go play it downtown at a, you know, crappy club in New York City for $50 once a month. And it turned into this.
Well, I've seen a couple of videos, you and lead singer Shannon Conley playing the Robert Plant character, sort of flirting off each other, you know. So how deeply into the tribute do you get? I know Beatles tribute bands, they speak in Liverpudlian accents or, you know, Stones. Do you mimic these personalities or moves?
First of all, let me just quickly say that we actually have a new singer with us for now a while now. She's absolutely marvelous. Her name is Marlene Angelidis. She's half Greek, and she actually does have a British accent. So there you have that. But so aside from that, we don't get into impersonation, which is why I like to say that Led Zeppelin is not a tribute band. In my mind, it's really not, because although I have been known to wear a dragon suit now and again, I do have one in my closet and a wizard suit and all that. But aside from the fun of that, they are not exact copies of anything Jimmy has. They're just kind of riffs off of his sort of couture. And that's kind of what we do. You know, we are in the spirit of the band very, very deeply. And I think it's the most important parts of Led Zeppelin, which is the passion with which they play, the intensity, the musicianship, and the sort of combo playing, you know, the way that Led Zeppelin, when they played live, which is what we do, we don't sort of do the records note by note, although we stay very true to many things, but there are improvisational parts. They'd huddle together in the middle of the stage, you know, the three of them, the four of them, and they would just go off into this playing off each other. And that, to me, is the most beautiful, most sort of precious part of that whole era of British blues rock. And Zeppelin did it as better than anybody, really. And that's what we try to do.
Let's hear a little bit more of that. This is the Lemon Song, Les Zeppelin with Lita Ford. She was the lead guitarist for the Runaways back in the 1970s.
I should have quit you, baby. Oh, such a long time ago.
We get there, that taste of the blues, you know, Led Zeppelin deeply, deeply influenced by the birth of the blues. Were you aware of that when you started playing?
It's really funny you should ask that, because to a certain extent, I was, but really, no. I was not primarily a blues guitarist, although I spent a lot of time seeing Jimi Hendrix first. and that really was my education into the blues. I actually was into jazz when I was a kid and really sort of went backwards. I started with jazz. I was Django Reinhardt was and maybe still is my favorite guitar player, but I didn't so much play gypsy jazz, but I was into all of that. And playing Led Zeppelin, I was, of course, aware that their roots came from the blues, but studying Jimmy's playing was another whole education for me. And it's not just the blues. That's a thing about Page's playing and about the band in general. But his playing pulls from all sorts of influences, British folk, psychedelic rock, rockabilly, blues, and he covers it all, having been a session guy. So it's really a challenge.
I'm speaking with Steph Payne. She's the founder and lead guitarist of the band Les Zeppelin. It's an all-female band that plays Led Zeppelin music, and they're going to be playing at the Flying Monkey in Plymouth on Friday. Well, apparently, Steph, you've met Jimmy Page. What was that like?
Yes. Well, I would say bucket list, but it's so beyond that. It's more like an entire well, like a... You know, it was a long time coming. That's all I can say, you know, having studied him for so long. He was the most lovely, gracious. The first time I met him was at a party after the premiere of Celebration Day, which was the film of their reunion concert in 2007 at the O2, which I actually was fortunate to have attended. So I met him in this crowded room after the premiere, and I was introduced to him, and he just stopped and he opened his arms and went, "Oh, it's about time," you know, and we
wow.
just embraced each other, because, you know, this is the thing about Jimmy, and he knows everything that has anything to do with Led Zeppelin that goes on in the universe.
He knew about you then?
Oh yeah, he knew about us. He'd heard our records then, at which point we embraced and all that, and the first thing I said to him, which was quite funny, was, "You know, Jimmy," I said, "I got to tell you, it's really hard being you." And he just he burst out laughing. Went, "Yeah, it is. I know." And I know. So we had this moment of very strange sort of you know, there aren't many people who know exactly how hard it is to be Jimmy in the universe. So, and then he said to me, "You're doing a magnificent job out there. Stunning, stunning, especially the first record."
Wow.
And that's the thing. He's really, you know, he's very, it's the love of his life. I mean, Led Zeppelin is it. And if it's anything, if anyone's doing any Zeppelin thing, he knows about it.
What a great compliment from him, and also for him to come to your show. But, you know, I can't help but think of this, that I remember I was actually doing research for another interview, and part of it was about rock and roll in the 60s and 70s. And I remember coming across an article about Robert Plant being named as having the best chest in rock and roll in 1973, you know, by like Cream magazine or something. But there is this kind of, you know, extreme maleness. They were so threatening, you know, packed into mm-hmm. their tight jeans and everything. So I'm wondering about that whole gender bending thing. How does that feel? Do you play that up? Do you see yourself as a gender bending band?
Well, we try to pack as tightly as possible into our jeans as well and do a fairly good job at it.
Do you get stopped at airports like they did in Spinal Tap?
Yeah, indeed. What is that? Is it magnetic? So, yes, in a way. I mean, it's very, very interesting, and I could talk for hours about this. Maybe another program will be dedicated to this. But when women take on this sort of role, as it were, of, you know, this sort of preening male rock god type of personality and player, it's a very, very interesting experience because it opens avenues that I think are not often, how do I put this, like encouraged in women. And you don't often see female performers being aggressive musically and on, struttingly on stage in the way that, you know, bands like Led Zeppelin were, certainly. They personified it. They were the top of their game, you know, the top of the game. And in doing that, in playing that part and letting that come out, it's a freeing and amazing thing because it's a very different approach. It's not, you know, the typical female sort of sexualness on stage is usually a kind of tempting, a temptress. Come, you know, don't you want me, sort of. You know, you're dressed in very little and you're tempting. That's always what's thought of as female sexual force. Well, this is totally different. This is where you're at the lip of the stage and you're like, I'm going to come get you. I'm coming to get you, baby. You know, it's a very different sort of thing, as subtle as that may seem. Mm. And so in many ways, you can say it's gender bending. And in many ways, it's really natural. And I think that, you know, I could talk about how, you know, female sexuality is not what people really think it is. You know, you find that out pretty fast. I mean, it's pretty natural and very empowering. You need cooler.
When you look out over the audience, who's there? Men, women, mix?
A mix, a total mix.
Really?
And, you know, everyone's turned on, yeah. I mean, it's and age groups, you know, because I think everyone at this point loves Led Zeppelin or has heard it. Like you said at the beginning of your program, you really can't get through a day and not hear Kashmir or Stairway or Rock and Roll or The Ocean or something. You know, it's just ubiquitous, really. And, you know, there are plenty of parents that come with their kids, moms and dads that come with their teenage kids or even younger. And the teenagers have Led Zeppelin as their favorite band.
They still play Stairway to Heaven at school dances, apparently.
That's awesome. It still wins number one. Yeah. People, yes, play Stairway. We actually didn't play that for 8 years, the first 8 years of the band. We, like, avoided playing Stairway.
Why?
Well, it was, you know, it's a bit like Hamlet's soliloquy. It's so, in essence, it's so brilliant, and it's, you know, that it's so overdone, it's so overplayed, that in a way, it's just almost hard to play, because it sounds cliche the second you just start playing it. You know, it's, all you think of is that Wayne's World movie, you know, or Stairway to Night or something. It's just, so we kind of shied away from it because it was just tough to figure out how to really deliver it without laughing or without being feeling it's too corny. But we kind of came back around to it because, you know, it is really an important piece.
Steph Paines, lead guitarist and founder of Les Zeppelin, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure, and I hope you get to catch the show.
You can see Les Zeppelin, the all-girl band, playing the music of Led Zeppelin at the Flying Monkey in Plymouth this Friday, March 31st.